I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to The Political Party. This episode features Nick Bowles, and if you've been following the news this week, well, he's been one of the most prominent names you'll have seen, sensationally resigning from the Conservative Party. After resigning from his local association, he finally had enough. And in this fascinating interview, he tells us all about how he got there. And you might be a bit surprised at which point he made the decision, and I won't ruin that at all. Nick was meant to do the Christmas special with Alistair Campbell, but sadly wasn't able to do it. So I'm trying to rearrange, and it's great to get him on. Especially, I mean, of all the weeks to talk to him, really, this is the best. So it's worked out in the end. And he's someone I've always admired. He's always been a reasonable voice, a calm voice, a pragmatic voice. You know, the sorts of Tory that people with my politics kind of, I suppose, warm to. And he's such a charming and decent man. I met him a couple of years ago. We were both on Peston on Sunday, and he was just such a nice, and it's not, you know what, it's not even about his politics. There are just some people, when you meet them for the first time, that are open and friendly and approachable, and he was very much like that. And not all politicians are like that, and indeed not all people are like that, and I just thought it said a lot about him. So it was a pleasure to talk to him. He's insanely modest, I think, is the way that I would sum him up. Good-humoured, good-natured, and, well, I shall not prolong this anymore. Oh, I do have some news. I'm doing the Bloomsbury Theatre, which is amazing. So we've extended the tour because, obviously, Brexit hasn't happened yet. And I'm delighted. Saturday the 25th of May, I'm doing the Bloomsbury Theatre in London with a fully updated, modernised Brexit Through the Gift Shop. So please buy tickets to that, because it's a bloody big room. So thank you in advance for some of them have already sold. It only went on sale this morning, so do get your tickets to that. That's Saturday the 25th of May in the Bloomsbury Theatre. What a way to I say end the tour. Who knows how long it's going to go on? I think that will be the end of it. So, oh my word, that's very exciting. Also, the future guests at the Political Party Live at the end of April will be Suella Braverman, leading member of the ERG. And at the end of May, Ken Clark. The tour continues as well. Faversham on Friday the 5th of April. I added an extra date at the Salford Lowry. That's on the 9th of May. I mean, Aberystwyth on the 10th of May. In Edinburgh on the 12th of May, Glasgow on the 13th of May, Newcastle on the 14th of May, Chorley on the 18th of May, and then Camberley on the 24th. And of course then, London, Bloomsbury Theatre on the 25th of May. So do get your tickets to that. I shall now leave you in the wonderful hands of Nick Bowles. Nick, what an incredible week to be talking to you, and thank you so much for coming in. I don't really know where to start. I mean, so many pieces of individual drama, but let's start with your announcement in the House of Commons, this hugely dramatic moment where you say, "I failed chiefly because my party refuses to compromise. I regret, therefore, to announce I can no longer sit for this party," and then you leave the chamber to applause on some of the opposition benches. And what is picked up on the mic is, I think it's Johnny Mercer.
No,
it's not.
It's Hugh Merriman.
Hugh Merriman goes, "Oh, Nick, don't go. Come on." This lovely kind of despair, but sort of very controlled despair in his voice. So firstly, how do you feel having taken this momentous decision?
Shell-shocked. I think it really is shell-shocked. And not, I don't regret it. In fact, it feels right, and in some ways inevitable, but nevertheless it is a very wrenching thing to do.
Oh, you can tell that it was, the emotion is clear on your voice. I mean, so many people listening to it will have seen the clip, and if not, you know, you can find it on the BBC website and YouTube and other places. To reach a point where a party that's been your life, that has been wedded to the values that you live and breathe, and a certain amount of personal ambition and all those things all together. It's been a vehicle for so many things. Then find yourself leaving it. Can't have been a decision you took lightly.
So the weird thing is that it was a spur-of-the-moment decision.
No way!
Yeah, but... And it's often happened to me in life. Most of the big decisions I've ever made are things that I've thought about a lot in advance. So it wasn't that I hadn't sort of played it out of my mind. And as you may know, I sort of parted company with my local party.
Yes.
A few weeks ago. But at the time, I was very, very clear in my mind that I wanted to stay as a Conservative MP and a member of the Conservative Party nationally, for all that I'd obviously fallen out with my local association over my attempts to stop no-deal Brexit. And I'd, at the time when I'd been preparing myself to take that step, I thought through, am I missing a trick here? Should I be being more honest with myself? Should I, actually go the whole hog? So I'd thought about it a lot, but I'd rejected it.
Yeah.
And then on Monday night, I did just snap. The final bit of elastic keeping me tied to, as you say, the political vehicle to which I've been attached for, best part of 20 years, snapped. And it was a decision. I didn't even know I was going to say what I said when I stood up. I mean, I got halfway through the sentence and decided that was the conclusion.
Oh, my God! Because I just presumed, that you'd... I mean, when you left your local association, I thought, well, now it's inevitable. There'll be a period of time and then you're kind of edging towards the door. And totally understandably. But to get up on on your feet in the floor of the House of Commons and to kind of only realise mid-sentence that you're resigning from the Conservative Party, the party of government, the party that you've served, and being close to its former leaders, it's just, I suppose subconsciously perhaps you made the decision and then your brain realised on your feet. I mean, was there any part of you that... it looks like on the video you leave the chamber completely. You then come into the members of it. I mean, is there any part of you that thinks, oh, God, what have I just done? I mean, the adrenaline must have gone mad.
Yes, no, but funnily enough, I walked very perfectly. I didn't go into members' lobby. I went straight into the I-lobby because my office is back right the other end in the other side of Portcullis House. And I just walked straight out. And a couple of people ran out. The Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Gavin Barwell, very nicely came out and just said, are you okay?
Oh, nice.
And then Rose, whose surname is so complicated I never remember it, the Speaker's chaplain, came rushing down the corridor as I was walking down it, just to again check that I was okay. And not at all, in Gavin's case, trying to, argue with me, just checking that I was okay.
Well, that's good.
Which is good. I'm not sure if I was okay, but I at least made as if I was, and walked back to my office, got out of my suit, got into my jeans, and got on the bus, on the number 12 bus, and went back to Camberwell, and then sort of collapsed on the sofa, and thought, wow, what's just happened?
And did anyone on the bus recognise you?
No. No,
not that you're aware.
I'm very happily. Very, very few people ever do. I'm not that kind of famous. So that didn't happen. I think people do underestimate sometimes with politicians. The extent to which emotions are an important factor. That for all that we are having arguments, usually, at least attemptingly, to be rational in our arguments.
Yes.
And to be, bringing forward evidence and logic and all of the other stuff of argument.
All the stuff that's gone out of fashion.
I think you're right. I think emotion, if anything, is more important now than it's ever been. But not just emotion in terms of the communication with voters and the public, but actually emotion in ourselves. And... you can think everything through and you can have a strategy and you can have tactics and you can have a plan, but ultimately also you're a human being.
Yes.
And sometimes human beings reach the end of their tether. And I reached the end of my tether on my feet you know, in the House of Commons on Monday night.
It's, I mean, that speech itself was powerful. There was something else you said in an interview with the BBC, that the moment I heard it, and when you see it written down, I can see students in A-level politics in 20 years starting a module with this quote at the top of the page, which is the Conservative Party doesn't exist anymore. It's two parties who happen to sit at the same side in the House of Commons. And that just feels like one of those quotes, a bit like the longest suicide note in history. It feels like a quote from someone on that side. It feels like such a crystallised observation, so accurate, but so damning and powerful. The Conservative Party doesn't exist anymore. And I know what you mean. Is the Conservative Party now doomed to split?
In a way, I think it has split. The question is, can it come back together?
Yeah.
It's not about whether it splits, it's whether it comes back together. And it takes all sorts of forms. You know, normally, as you well know, the House of Commons is it's a totally dysfunctional place, as will come as no surprise to any of your listeners. But we try and maintain a sort of jokey, friendly, hello, you know, without actually ever listening to anyone or showing any interest in their lives. But still, we maintain the pretense of cordiality and yes. camaraderie. And not just within parties, across parties too. Though often it's easier across parties. But one tries to do it within parties. And I've certainly always tried to do it. And I don't have, you know, close friendships in politics other than one, but I have, you know, friendly political friendships, what I'd call them. Yeah. And one of my political friends has always been Jacob Rees-Mogg, and I didn't know him well before coming in, but we came in on the same day. We actually chose to sit next to each other in the House of Commons. You find your own seat, and yeah. it's quite an odd process because you literally could sit anywhere on your side's benches. It's obviously not allocated to you because there aren't enough seats for everyone, but you basically decide, this is where I feel comfortable. Yeah. And it helps the speaker then to know where you are, so that if the speaker wants to call you, they know where to find you. I sat next to Jacob, right far away from the speaker's chair, with yeah. this sort of perspective down the whole of the chamber, which I really liked. And over the years, Jacob, who's a much more regular attender of Commons debates than I've ever been, but nevertheless, when I was there, you know, I'd talk to him because he's a fascinating man. He's got yes. a huge amount of knowledge about Parliament and history, and I'm historically completely uneducated and illiterate. And so I would, you know, always ask Jacob about what's this and what happened then and how does this work. And so we, you know, struck up one of those political friendships.
Yes.
We'd never see each other in outside of Parliament, but we liked each other, enjoyed each other's company. He's a funny man, made each other laugh, and would always be cheerful and friendly towards each other. And unfortunately, that's sort of gone.
Oh man!
And I've felt over the last few weeks that where I sit next to him, maybe because of he's a centre of gravity, or maybe it's just chance, has sort of become the ERG, the Brexiter, end of the bench.
Yeah.
And so you've got Bill Cash is nearby, and various other senior figures. Steve Baker sits around there, Richard Drax, Marcus Fish. So it's become the sort of ERG headquarters. And then actually the people who I've most associate myself with, identify with, and have been working with most closely in these recent months, Oliver Letwin, Nicholas Soames, Richard Bennion, Jonathan Janogli, Antoinette Sambatch, they all sit right at the other end, near the speaker's chair. And I always thought, I'm not going to move just because, you know, I disagree with yeah. Jacob, that would be giving in. But it's felt increasingly odd and a little uncomfortable, and not because I'm hastened around, not because there's been any unpleasantness right. or anything from any
okay.
of, no, not for a second. So it's all about me. This is what's been going on in my head.
Okay.
I've just felt I don't belong here. this is not my home anymore. These are not my people anymore. And that is why I think I said what I said to Laura Koonsberg, which is that the Conservative Party doesn't exist anymore. Because once you've lost that feeling, I don't know whose line it is, but the ties that bind, the ties that bind have disappeared.
Just on your relationship with Jacob then, and how difficult that is to say, I totally understand why, when things are becoming so divided and divisive, you don't want to be sitting near the people in your party you agree with the least, and that they weren't necessarily hostile to you. But is it just that you would hear them muttering things that you disagreed with and thought, I just don't want to hear this? Is it like muting someone on Twitter?
Yes, it is quite similar to that, because what they would do is that, that they would groan or heckle when somebody else said something that I profoundly agreed with and was delighted by.
Yeah.
And so there's a sort of dissonance builds up between you and them. And, I think we have to be honest about this. I have been entirely focused now for 4 months on denying them their dream.
Yeah.
Now, not Brexit, because I believe we need to Brexit, and I keep on voting for Brexit. But a no-deal Brexit, which in truth most of them now would prefer. They actually would prefer to leave without a deal, what they call a clean break Brexit. And I have literally spent all of my time and all of my energy and all of my emotional and other resources on trying to stop that from happening. And of course it reached its culmination yesterday with this bill that Oliver Letwin and Yvette Cooper managed to get through with one vote. And so I can completely understand. They're pretty furious with me. They've been working for this for a very, very long time indeed. And they have, they see it slipping through their fingers. So I don't blame them for any sort of lingering hostility that might be there. Though, again, I want to emphasise that there's never been anything said that was, angry or offensive. Yeah. It's more a mood.
But you've never said to Jacob, oh, come on, man, you've just been a bit unreasonable. Like, the way you're behaving isn't becoming of a Conservative MP. Have you ever challenged them even gently about the way they behave?
No. So I have not with Jacob. I have challenged, but on Twitter, not in conversation, some of what Marc François has said.
I was going to ask you about Marc François,
which I think has overstepped, quite a lot of lines. With Jacob, it's more. I have had the conversation with him. I think probably before Meaningful Vote 2, where I just said to him, Jacob, why can't you do this? You'll get what you want. It will get us, we'll be out of the EU by the 29th of March. You'll then be able to, go from there. This is a process, not a event, all of the arguments. And in a very sort of easy, friendly, but slightly pleading way. And he took it, as he always does. He engaged with it seriously. And we talked about, is it the DUP that he needs to enable him to be able to take that decision. Obviously, he did ultimately for not really Meaningful Vote 3, but Meaningful Vote 2.5, as people call it. He did take that step, though I think pretty reluctantly. But no, I haven't. You try not to have stand-up, confrontations.
Yes.
Because my view is, we've all thought about this quite hard. We've all come to our conclusions. What I say is not going to persuade Jacob Rees-Mogg or Bill Cash, who've been, on this bandwagon for decades, nor is what they say going to persuade me.
No.
So let's just try and be polite and friendly.
But what, what really saddens me in a way, and it sounds so, someone who's never voted Conservative is, I have a huge respect for political parties and I have a huge amount of respect for the Tory party, particularly the kind of Conservative that you are, the kind of, national interest, liberal, internationalist. And I just think you're such a huge loss. And I think it's almost the same with, the way the Labour Party is going, is these two great parties that have done so much good for the country and the world now seem to be in hock to a minority interest on both sides. And where the Labour issue with Momentum has been very widely publicised and very vocal, it seems to have been a little bit not. It's been done in a different way with the Tories, but out of the sort of Aaron Banksification, this leave.eu transition into a kind of deselection movement within the Tory party hasn't had the same attention that the Labour problems have had. Maybe because it's not as widespread, maybe because the leader isn't necessarily on side. I get that. But nevertheless, the reality of it for you has basically been you've had a right-wing momentum in your constituency. You've had new members join, take over the party, and change the tone of your local politics. I mean, is that an accurate kind of assessment of what's happened?
It's not entirely accurate. It's an exaggeration. I mean, the first thing to say, just because, you know, you were kind enough to say that I'm a great loss, the truth is none of us is even vaguely indispensable. I mean, you know, there are any number of people who will come in behind, you know, dead men's shoes, as it were, and you know, there are lots of great new people in the party, and there are, you know, there's people far greater and more important than me, like Ruth Davidson and Johnny Mercer, and, you know, like reel off names. So I don't actually buy that just as a matter of, you know, how life and politics works. You know, the waters will close over my head. Nobody will remember my name.
No,
I'm not being self-pitying. I actually genuinely, I just don't, I think there's a complete delusion, this idea that, you know, there's probably one or two important figures in each generation, but no more. And I'm not one of this generation's one or two. What I think is important is what is happening collectively, sort of to the organisation, as it were, of the Conservative Party. And, of course, as ever with the Conservative Party, it's a bit of a sort of muddle, and it's a bit of a mess, but it's not a plot, it's not a conspiracy in the sort of way that you feel that, you know, Momentum was a pretty well-planned takeover of a, you know, slightly moribund organisation. With a lot of people who, you know, were... who is it who said that, you know, the problem with socialism, it takes too many evenings? Oscar Wilde, I think it was.
Yeah.
You know, the Conservatives aren't like that. It's all much more haphazard. Now, what happened with my association, I think it would be wrong to say that it was, you know, straightforward infiltration by former UKIP members who then immediately, you know, orchestrated by leave.eu, tried to push me out. That's not true. What happened was, firstly, that I was selected in an open primary. Not actually an open primary in the sense where every voter got a ballot paper, which is how Sarah Wollaston was selected. But mine was, what technically you would call an open caucus. So it was a meeting at which members of the public could come who weren't members of the Conservative Party. And as a result, the meeting had roughly 300 Conservatives in it and probably 60 or 80 concerned members of the public who wanted to select the next Conservative candidate because they knew that was probably the best way they'll have influence over their MP, given it was a fairly reliably Conservative seat. And I won it, but quite narrowly. I'm almost certain because the 60 to 80 voted for me.
Yeah.
So I won it off the back of the votes of people who are not members of the local Conservative Association. So I was already, in a sense, slightly semi-detached.
Yeah.
And, you know, I liked the people there and I tried hard and they tried hard. And in that rather sort of English way, we all tried to see the best in each other. But there were always a rump, because they were actually quite powerful, a cabal of people who never liked me, never voted for me, and I wasn't their kind of conservative. They didn't like David Cameron either, but they sort of swallowed it because they thought it might get us back into power.
Yeah.
They got quite stroppy over gay marriage, which they blamed me for, not without some reason, because I was probably the closest gay friend that David Cameron had.
Yes.
But nevertheless, I sort of got over that hump, as it were, with them. But so they were always there. And then what happened after the referendum and after the 2017 election was a lot of former Conservative members who had resigned over gay marriage rejoined the party, plus a few people who had been active members of UKIP locally. Now, some of those former Conservatives had voted UKIP and then come back. Some of them had even joined UKIP. And then, you know, there was a local UKIP councillor who we welcomed with open arms, because he said, you know, I've always been a Conservative. I cared a lot about Europe and the referendum. You're now delivering what I've always wanted on that, so I'll be a Conservative again. Yeah. And of course, you know, as a political party, you say, great, come back. Yeah. And he's a good man and he's a good councillor. But what he did was what you naturally do in politics. He got all his mates in.
Yes.
Because he was running the local branch and he then got all his mates in. Yeah. And then when I declared that I would do literally anything to stop no deal Brexit, it was like lighting a match to a you know, bone dry bonfire. And they off they went. And what happened was that the people who, in a sense, always hated me suddenly saw an opportunity to coalesce with this new group who really, really cared about this one issue,
yeah,
on which I was being particularly outspoken. And they just made it ever increasingly clear that they were going to get rid of me if they had half a chance. And initially I thought, well, I'm just not going to give them half a chance.
Yeah.
And indeed, I could have carried on avoiding the issue just because they have actually no constitutional power to initiate a deselection at this early stage. You know, we haven't got an election due for 3 years. But then I just thought, I'm not sure if I'm really ready to do this anymore. I don't know whether I want to stand again in 2022. Mm-hmm. I didn't then know. It's a long way off. I'm 53. I've, you know, had cancer twice. Am I really going to do this all over again? So I thought, why put them through misery and myself through misery when actually there's a solution, which is that I part company with them. They can go off and select a candidate in their own image, and I can you know, serve out my term and be true to myself.
Yeah.
So that, you know, in a sense, isn't a story of a organised momentum takeover by the hard right. And I think the same's true, you know, in all of these different stories in, you know, Dominic Grieve's constituency, it is a bit more orchestrated because it's the former UKIP parliamentary candidate who's been in Sam Giemer's constituency. I understand from him, it's actually not really about Brexit at all. It's a group of people who never liked him, quite possibly for quite unpalatable reasons, who are now using this as an excuse. You know, in Anna Soubry's constituency, you know, it was another thing altogether. So in that classic Tory way, it's a bit of a muddle, and it's not particularly planned. But the overall impact of it is that it's because dogma has entered the bloodstream of the Tory party. And that is where the similarity with Momentum and the Labour position lies, is that ultimately what is driving this activity is ideological fixation, which is not a Conservative habit of mind.
What's a real shame is when personal relationships break down or you're suffering abuse. And I just wonder, you know, people can disagree with you and say, look, Nick, I'm a Conservative, but I really believe in a no-deal, clean break, WTO Brexit, whatever. Sadly, that does sometimes morph into personal animosity and hatred. And or even though you've sort of brushed it off with a great deal of good humour, you had messages, one person saying they're going to cut your balls off. I mean, is this... How bad was it? I mean, did you get much face-to-face stuff?
No, actually, I always find that the British are always, you know, terrifyingly polite when you actually meet them face-to-face. So, like many MPs, when somebody sends me a particularly ranty email, what I often do is invite them to come in and see me at the surgery.
And how many do?
Quite a few.
Wow.
And you know, they come in and you think that they come in determined to say what they really think and speak their mind. And it's amazing how few of them do. and, you know, it doesn't take much to make them sort of understand that you're a reasonable bloke and that you disagree, but you're not the sort of spawn of Satan. My main approach to this, which is, I must say, one I would recommend to not just to MPs, but to anybody in even vaguely public life, is I never, ever, ever look at what people say on Twitter in response to a tweet I've sent. I do not see Twitter as a conversation. It is a place where I broadcast.
It's a notice board.
Yeah. And I'm amazed. And I understand if you're a journalist, there's a, you know, you're meant to engage with your readers and enter into a conversation. I completely get that. And that's a different profession and it's perhaps got different requirements. But if you're a politician, maybe if you're in a very marginal seat, you suddenly think this is the way to, you know, secure those sort of ties of loyalty and understanding. But generally, I think it's just really bad for your mental health.
Yes.
And, you know, if you're in politics, you know, one of the things you really have to work out quite early on is whose opinion do you care about, really care about, as in personally care about, and then ignore everybody else. You know, I don't give a stuff what anybody writes about me in some column, let alone on some, you know, mad tweet sent at 1 a.m. when they're drunk and sitting in their underpants on their sofa. They can say what the hell they like about me. You know, I'm a public figure. Of course they can. But I'm not going to dignify it by reading it.
Have you always had that approach? Or is this... you know, you say you've survived cancer twice. I'm sure that has given you a fresh perspective on life and existence and what struggle is. Is that partly a kind of kernel of that experience that you think, actually, I've been to hell and back and a tweet compared is nothing? Or did you always have that view?
So I suspect it's a combination. One of the things I enjoyed, that the funny thing is when you do what I did on Monday night, people for 24 hours are just incredibly nice to you and about you. And you know perfectly well it won't last, but enjoy it while it does. One of the people who I've been working with most closely on this Brexit plan, Comment Market 2.0, that I have been trying to promote is Lucy Powell, who's Labour MP for Manchester Central, former chief staff to Ed Miliband, and who I didn't know at all before, and who I just think is absolutely terrific. She's right up there and with Jess Phillips in my list of Labour crushes. And she sent this tweet after I sort of left the Conservative Party, with some very nice adjectives describing me, but the one that was my favourite, which I don't, I sort of, one of those adjectives you rather dream about people saying about you, was steely.
Oof.
I liked steely very much indeed. and I think that I have probably become more steely since being ill. I was about to say something rude, but you know, I couldn't give a flying. and I think that is definitely emphasised by recovering from illness. You focus on the stuff that matters. One of my closest friends sent me, it's a very famous New Yorker cartoon, but it did make me roar with laughter. Which has a man looking rather harassed at his desk, and some friend or contact is obviously calling him, asking him if he'd like to meet for lunch or dinner. And the man is saying, "Thursday? No, I can't do Thursday. How about never? Would never work for you?" and that is slightly become my attitude to most social engagements and interactions with, you know, people other than the people I really love, my family and, you know, my husband and my very close friends. And I think it does thicken your skin, the experience of having to confront mortality.
Because you were, I mean, the famous or infamous picture of you being wheeled out of hospital to vote in 2017 in one of those first rounds of Brexit votes.
Article 50.
Very, very, yes, it was Article 50. Very powerful image.
But let me tell you something here, because what I would hate people to think was that was all, you know, honour and principle and, you know, deep commitment to the cause. Of course, there was an element of that. You know, I was painfully aware that I hadn't voted for Brexit.
Yeah.
But that my constituents had. And I wanted to send a message to them that that I was going to represent them and deliver this result. And I indeed feel I've been trying to do that consistently since then. But there was another element too, which was I cooked it up with the whips. Because I don't know if you remember, but Diane Abbott suddenly announced that she had a cold.
That's right.
And that, unfortunately, a headache, it's a bad headache, and she was going to have to miss the division.
Yeah.
And what the whips and I thought was that it would be a rather nice counterpoint if this guy who was going through chemotherapy came out in a wheelchair with a mask on his face, was wheeled in.
Oh, man.
And that, of course, but I think there's something important there, which is that politics is always a mixture of high and low.
Yes.
And don't ever trust somebody who's only high.
Oh, always.
Because the truth is they'll lead you into terrible places.
Yeah.
You know, the high and mighty, highfalutin, sort of, you know, holier than thou, God forbid.
You might be thinking of.
There's got to be a bit of raw, you know, gamesmanship.
Yeah, and kind of own it. I spoke to George Osborne on the show last week. And
he has a little too much.
Well, he's always been so openly political, but I like that. And you know, when you watch, whenever I go to America and you watch their political chat shows there, they're so open about their tactics and their strategy. Yeah. They're just open. They say, well, we're targeting these voters because if we get the Hispanic vote, you think, we would never do... You know,
a
British politician would never say, well, we're deliberately targeting black people because if they vote, then Labour is sorted. You know, you just would never... That might be the truth, but you don't go out and say it.
No,
so, in a way, I always respect those people who do say...
Yeah, well, pretty naked about
that's
it.
That's why we're doing it. that's a great... you know what? It's because there's been so much...
Can I just have to tell you... Because it only just came to my mind. Who the whip was? The whip was Steve Barclay, the current Brexit secretary.
Wow!
He came down to King's College Hospital. he took me out of my room. Wheeled me along the passageway, and I got a ride in the chief whip's car too.
Oh, lovely! I mean, it's not quite, a point about high and low. It's more of different futures you could have had. A sliding doors moment, if you like, which I suppose Brexit caused. Which you were very close to David Cameron. For a period, you know, he was the Tories' bright hope. He'd effectively got Labour out of power after 13 years. He then gets his own majority in 2015. There was a huge possibility there for the Tory party to truly modernise and seize the centre ground, and you would have absolutely been at the heart of that, not just as an ally, but someone who's with a policy brain and all the work you've done with Policy Exchange and all this. You were kind of part of a team, I mean, potentially a future Prime Minister at one point, and now you're not even a Tory Member of Parliament.
I'm the sole member of the party that doesn't exist. I know. It's funny how life works. But the good thing about cancer is that the one thing you no longer care about is things like that, frustrated dreams and all of that. I funny enough, late last night, after the very late, very close vote on the bill that I've been heavily involved in, I was meeting with Oliver Letwin, with a member of the cabinet who will remain nameless. And on his wall were photographs of... There's always a sort of formal cabinet photo.
Yes, in the pillared room.
Yes, exactly. And it was of the Prime Minister's, Theresa May's, cabinets, both after she took over in 2016 and then after the election in 2017. And I sort of looked up and Oliver was standing next to me, and I said to... I said to Oliver, were you in that one? And then he said, no, these were all since me. And I said, oh, well, that was once a dream of mine. And it was odd because though it sounded like it was wistful,
yes,
I didn't feel any wistfulness.
No.
And it's curious that, because if you'd asked me, you know, even recently, I probably would have expected to feel wistful that, you know, the ambitions and hopes that I once had. Had not materialised, and now, you know, won't materialise. But actually, I don't feel wistful at all. I've had many different kinds of experience. And actually, funnily enough, though it's been the most stressful and pressured, the experience for the last few months has been the best of all by a country mile.
Selling a little? Or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door.
Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You say that those ambitions won't be realised, and I kind of understand what you mean. However, politics is now volatile. Both parties are splitting or will split or are going through this crisis. You've got the independent group or Change UK, whatever they're going to be called, this sort of new, you know, that is still very new and it's high risk, potentially high reward, who knows. You know, in a volatile general election, if people don't want Jeremy Corbyn and they blame Theresa May for a damaging Brexit, you could be part of some sort of centre ground movement, perhaps. I mean, have you talked to any members of the independent group? They must be trying to get you to join.
I mean, obviously some of them are political friends of mine, like Anna Soubry and Sarah Wollaston particularly. But I've been very clear that I don't want to join them.
Why?
And I think that what they're doing is admirable and I hope it succeeds. And I think it might succeed. But I don't want to be part of it. They have defined themselves, and I think the pollsters might well say very intelligently, they've defined themselves as the party of Remain. Mm. If one's being cruel, the party of Ramon, the difference being that, you know, they actually want to stop it.
Yes.
And that is clearly a bit of, leave aside the principle, which I think for all of them is very genuine and sincere. It's also, I think, probably quite a clever piece of political positioning, because all of the evidence suggests that people are increasingly defining themselves by their referendum vote.
Yes.
And that there will be a huge body of voters who define themselves by their horror at the idea of leaving the European Union and their desire to either not leave or get back in as soon as possible. I genuinely, sincerely do not believe that that is the right course for the country. I just, for all that I was a Remainer, I think that we have to find a new kind of relationship with the people and the countries to our east. And I think that the kind of relationship we tried for the last, you know, 40 years, you know, worked for a while and then stopped working. And that's in truth been our history for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
You know, no pattern has ever worked for very long. And we tried marrying them and we tried invading them and we tried, you know, balance of power politics. Yeah. And we've tried everything. And nothing ever lasts very long. It lasts for 30, 40 years. And I think we need a new kind of relationship. And so I just can't, you know, if nothing else, the one advantage of my current position is that I can pretty much stick to what I believe in. And I'm not going to pretend to believe in that. The other thing is, I just, as though it's a completely separate point, I think it's a very, it's a long-term game realigning British politics.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen in 2 or 3 years. I think it might start to happen in 2 or 3 years. And I'm not sure if, you know, I'm got it in me, bluntly. I've been in for a while. I'm 53.
That's young.
I know. I mean, I'm not saying it's old, but I'm just not sure if I have it in me to do another 10 or 15 years is what I think it takes. I think it needs, you know, 35-year-olds and 40-year-olds who actually think I'm going to be part of this and I'm going to take it from nothing, which is pretty much where TIG is, to the very peak. But, you know, the Chukaramunas are a much better place personally to do that than I think I feel.
Well, yes, but you have a contribution to make. I mean, let's say there's another referendum and people then overturn the 2016 result and we vote to stay in. Let's say that happens. So, you know, that's not...
I won't vote Remain, by the way. If there's another referendum, I won't vote Remain.
Why?
Because we need a new relationship with Europe. It's broken. It's done. And, you know, for all that, you know, there might be a different result. And, of course, I'll accept that result like I'm trying to accept yeah. the result of the last one. I think it would... I mean, I think another referendum would be an enormous mistake. Yeah. I voted for it on Monday night, slightly regret it, but I was trying to get everybody to vote for anything they could live with.
Yes.
And I was also trying to get referendum supporters to vote for Common Market 2.0, which was only moderately successful, as it turned out. But I'll never vote for again. I just think it's a grave, grave error.
Okay. But let's say you vote leave or whatever that is, and you're unsuccessful, and we vote to rejoin or stay in the European Union. Then that means, obviously not that the issue goes away, far from it, but then it means that at least Change UK or the independent group aren't then just about trying to frustrate a referendum result. They're then perhaps still protecting a Remain vote, but they're then broadening out their offer. Once that, you know, that is then the will of the people. Is that something that you could then theoretically get involved in?
I mean, I'm a great believer in, you know, that nothing is impossible, because I didn't think I was going to be an independent progressive conservative this time last week. So you should never rule anything out. But it would require me to be absolutely committed to standing in 2022, which is when I think the next election will be, because I don't think there are more than 100 MPs who would vote for an early election at the moment. And I'm not sure I want to do that.
Or maybe some sort of TIG alliance where, apart from on Brexit, maybe you're broadly in agreement with them.
So do you know the funny thing is, and I don't quite know why this is, I genuinely admire them and know a few of them and like them. But they're not actually the people on the other side who I most chime with.
Oh, that's really interesting.
And the people I most chime with are, so, Lucy Powell.
Yeah.
Jess Phillips. Liz Kendall.
Yes.
Peter Kyle.
Love Peter Kyle.
Norman Lamb in the Lib Dems. Ben Lake in the Plaid Cymru.
Alison McGovern.
Alison, yes, less so, but I mean, I have a lot of admiration for her. Stephen Gethins in the SNP.
He's brilliant.
Now, maybe that these people, the people I've been working with to try and construct my coalition, as it were, for the compromise. But I really, really, I admire them. I like them. I believe in them. I feel trust in them.
Yes.
And I don't think they're all going to leave their parties.
Certainly not the SNP.
To join TIC.
No.
But not even, you know, Jess Phillips and Lucy Powell.
No.
You know, I think that they may, you know, join up with Tom Watson's, you know, attempt to
Future
sort of
Britain
wrest
Britain.
Back the control of the Labour Party. And I wish them the best of luck. So that's why I feel like it's not obvious to me that the new force that might have the most electoral chance, which is probably where TIG is trying to position itself, I don't think it's necessarily for me.
So, I mean, that's an interesting question. So let's discount the SNP, because they're never going to leave the SNP.
No.
And obviously Scotland's place in the union would be a red line.
Though I do tease Stephen Gethins, because basically he's married to a girl from Kent.
Oh, they're all. Angus Robertson was born in Wimbledon. Like, there's a lot of there's a lot in people's history, and that's true of all political parties, of course. But I suppose what you're maybe hinting at, consciously or otherwise, is a potential realignment with other people might be more attractive. So if Lucy Powell, Jess Phillips, and the other people, Peter Kyle, left but didn't join TIG, but said, let's set up something else. Now, whether they're on, you know, that is too similar ground, and what would the real distinction between Labour TIG and them be? But a realignment around something else might tickle your fancy.
Yes, but I don't think it's a party.
No, okay.
I think it's an approach to politics. So what the thing that I guess that I've been most churning away at the back of my mind while doing all of this stuff for on Brexit is the idea that MPs of different parties in a hung parliament, and hung parliament's kind of key to this.
Yes.
But I think we're likely to have hung parliaments till the eye, as far as the eye can see. That in a hung parliament, that MPs of different parties with common interests and in objectives working together to bring them about. And it started for me before this whole Brexit campaign. When I came back from being ill, I started writing a book online, sort of policy manifesto called Square Deal, which was inspired by Teddy Roosevelt, who was president and Republican president, but a very progressive Republican president in the United States at the turn of the century, and who reformed capitalism and created national parks and did lots of wonderful things. And he's a great inspiration to me. And one of the proposals in the book was for a hypothecated tax, so a dedicated tax base, to take national insurance, turn it into an NHS tax so that we fund the NHS separately from everything else. It has its own tax. We all pay it out of our wages. We all know our employers pay it too. And I, I then sort of reached out to Sarah Wollaston, who's chair of the Health Select Committee, who's then obviously a Conservative, to Liz Kendall, who's passionate about health and is also on the Select Committee, to Norman Lamb, who was a health minister in the in the coalition, Oliver Letwin, and actually to Nick McPherson, who's now a member of the House of Lords but was permanent secretary at the Treasury. And we sort of worked together on a campaign to try and get the government to think about, you know, a hypothecated funding system for the NHS as the best way of persuading the British people that they needed to pay a bit more to have the NHS funded properly, but that they would need the reassurance of knowing that the money they were paying was going into the NHS and only in the NHS.
Yeah.
And that was where it sort of sowed the seed for me of this approach. And I, you know, what I, the sort of the brand in my mind is Together. The best things that people do are the things they do together with other people. And you, that you come together around an idea, around a cause. You don't have to necessarily confine yourself in a permanent structure of a political party. You're more fluid than that and will be together with some people. So I've then, since then, you know, I've probably been involved in two processes. The process which culminated last night in the bill being passed, the Cooper-Letwin bill. Now that is something I've done together with Oliver Letwin, Yvette Cooper, Hilary Benn, Norman Lamb, Liz Kendall, Jack Dromey, Caroline Spellman. But then the Common Market 2.0 proposal for Brexit, that I've done together with different people. So some overlap, but with Rob Halfon, the MP for Harlow, with Stephen Kinnock, the MP for Aberavon, with Lucy Powell, who I've talked about, the MP for Manchester Central. And I think, for me, that's what's the most rewarding. And I think that there's some bigger potential to it. It's not just about my way of doing things. I think it's a sort of grown-up way of doing politics that I think people will respond to, because they'll see that you're not being too party political, that you're not worrying about, you know, which party is going to own this policy, who's going to benefit from it at the polls, but you are genuinely, you're not being starry-eyed about it. You're genuinely trying to get stuff done, and in a parliament that has no majority and where party whipping and discipline has completely evaporated, you know, if I can find 10 people who say this is what we want and we will vote to secure it and we will withhold our votes if you don't give it to us, I think I can start having, you know, some quite persuasive conversations with the Chancellor of the Exchequer or, you know, the Chief Whip of the Conservative Party or whatever. So that's if I have a plan, which, you know, it's slightly making it up as I talk, a bit like everything else I do, it's roughly that, is to spend the next 3 years seeing if one can... I'll give you another example. I took over as the chair of the APPG, the All-Party Parliamentary Group, on assisted dying. I think it's, you know, mad that we don't have any kind of way for people with terminal illnesses to organise the end of their lives in a sort of civilised way at a time of their own choosing. And, you know, they have it now in Canada, they have it in certain parts of Australia, they have it in Oregon. And that is a classic... It's not a party political issue. It's barely even a political issue.
Yes.
It's a philosophical issue, but it's also a sort of humanity issue. And, it, you know, the public are the sort of 80, 90% support for it. But Parliament, of course, is sort of stuck and keeps on voting against it. Now, that, you know, is a, as a cause, to find the people and bring them together to try and make that. A bit like gay marriage actually ended up, was not a party political issue. You know, David Cameron led it, but, you know, it wasn't the majority of the Conservative Party who voted for it. It was the Liberal Democrats, it was Labour, it was SNP. He constructed a coalition behind a particular issue. Now, of course, you can't do that for day-to-day stuff,
no,
like budgets and the like. But I'm not so interested in those bits now. You know, find two or three really important, yeah, things and get them done together with other people.
There is a world that exists in a parallel universe where we never had a Brexit referendum and David Cameron continues on for a few years and the party continues to modernise, perhaps, and ideas like this and people like you ended up being far more influential at the heart of government and not having to do it from, you know, from the back benches.
Oh, I don't agree with that at all. I really don't agree with that. If that alternative history,
yeah,
had happened, you know, I'd be stooging away rather, you know, unsuccessfully and predictably as, you know, Secretary of State for Transport or something like, yeah, that. And, you know, I'd be voting with the whip every night and, you know, I'd be arguing for my public spending round and, yes, I'd get frightfully excited about some new eco bus that I'd managed to launch. I think that for all that it's been deeply painful and divisive and, you know, there's a lot of risks attached, I actually think that the effect of Brexit, though it's not just Brexit, it's also, I think, the financial crash on the political system. I mean, it is, I think I said to Laura Koonsberg early in the week, it's like a meteor has hit the political system.
Yes.
And I actually think that as a result, our political system and the potential and the opportunities for MPs in Parliament are greater than at any time in my lifetime. You know, for individual MPs and groups of individual MPs, working together, I think it's never been greater.
Do you have a feeling now? Do you think, you know, if you've not made your mind up that you're going to stand at the next section, do you think, actually, I'm going to sort of indulge some of my passions now that I've kind of left the Conservative Party? You know, are you going to go to Ibiza and listen to house music again, or is that something that you've continued to do, or was that, you know?
Well, when I got home,
did that have to stop after a while?
When I got home from my ride on the number 12 bus on Monday night, I did check Skyscanner for flights to Ibiza.
Wow, there you go, I was close.
I did think to myself, maybe that's what I need. But then I suddenly realised, of course, we were going to have the votes on the bill. I'd been working on it for so long, I wasn't going to miss the... And as it turns out, my vote was kind of important,
yes,
given it, yeah, one by one. No. But yes, I am inclined to indulge myself a bit, but also fortunately, I think one of the other effects, perhaps, of illness is that you're not greedy anymore. I don't long to own things or do things or, you know, go places or,
yeah,
you know, I don't have social ambition or any of that sort of stuff. I know the things I like. The one thing I would like to do more, which I haven't done for a long time, is ski. And I'm,
okay,
a bit cross that this year Brexit has prevented my return. Not very elegant, I have to add, return to the slopes. But
hopefully it won't frustrate your travel plans. You'll be in a different queue next time because we'll have left.
Yes, that is true.
You'll have to queue longer to get to the Alps or whatever.
I think my honest prediction, so long as we do manage to leave,
yeah,
with a deal, my honest prediction is that almost nothing is going to change.
So there'll be a kind of EU plus UK queue rather than us having to go.
But no, not just on that, nothing's going to change. Literally on everything, nothing's going to change. So why, I mean, the reason why I was a Remainer, because I wasn't, you know, I was in no way an enthusiast about the EU. I spent 4 years as a minister without ever going to Brussels. I'm quite proud of that. But the reason why I was a Remainer was I just didn't think it was worth the hassle of leaving. And I'm absolutely certain that I'm going to be proven right.
I think you've probably already been proven right in that sense. But so you're getting into house music as a younger man. I mean, you're still young.
This is a slight myth. So
is it?
Well, I mean, isn't it?
I sort of have visions of you at Ministry of Sound, you know, off your face on MDMA.
No.
Paul Oakenfold.
I mean, I wouldn't have any problem admitting if I was. I'm not. I'm too much of a control freak to enjoy drugs. I don't like that feeling of losing control of my mind. Yeah. But no, this was slight myth. So there was this, what's it called? Profile, I think it's called.
Yes.
And it's a weird thing. I'd never heard of it before. But they interview people who are close to you, but they don't interview you.
Yeah.
And they did give me the opportunity to suggest a few people. And I suggested, you know, one of my sisters and my best friend and Michael Gove, who's my other best friend. But then I also suggested a great friend of mine who's a sort of a clubbing friend of mine from the old days called Brian Palm, who's a social worker. And he, while none of what he said was wrong or untrue, it sort of created this rather misleading impression that somehow I was this incredible raver, you know, and, you know, doing my mixing and all of that sort of stuff. Whereas the truth is, I'm just a slightly ridiculous, enthusiastic dancer. But I never know what it is I'm listening to. I'm not, you know, one of those people who, I've only been to Glastonbury once.
Yeah.
Lost my keys in the mud.
Yeah. I lost my phone last time I went.
The keys was a real nightmare because I'd locked everything in the car.
Oh,
literally everything.
Man.
We had this very clever plan, which we were going, it was Sunday night, we were going to listen to Beyonce, and then we were going to drive out Sunday night to miss the Monday.
Absolutely, it's a good idea.
So we put everything, tent, everything other than the clothes we were standing in,
yeah,
into the car, locked it, then lost the keys in the mud. Had nowhere to sleep.
Did you have to break the window?
Called, you know, the Subaru, whatever, who said that they'd come the next day.
To Glastonbury?
Charged me a fortune to break into the car. I mean, the cost was just spectacular. No. And we literally retraced my steps for the whole day to try and find these bloody keys. Of course, we never did.
No.
And then, amazingly, you know, weeks later, Glastonbury sent them to me because, you know, they then
plough up. Of course, they combed the site afterwards.
And,
yeah.
And of course, they were sort of 6 inches down in the mud. I have to say, it was my husband, and I'm never allowed to talk about him in public, so I won't say anything more about him, but as a test of a relationship, you know, I made him walk for 4 hours around the site, and he never once breathed even a word or a sigh or a scowl of, you know, you bloody fool.
I mean, it happens, doesn't it? And you walk in a lot at Glastonbury as well. It's a big place. It's a knackering place to go.
Funny enough, I'm trying to work out. I mean, I haven't got tickets, so I'd have to blag some, but I'm quite keen to go this year.
I'm going this year.
Because the Killers, I know it's a sort of, I'm afraid the Killers are a slightly sort of Tory band favourite, which is slightly
they're
weird.
Brilliant.
But last time I saw them was at the Albert Hall. I think they're absolutely brilliant. And Status Quo?
Oh, it's not.
Is it not Status Quo?
I saw Status Quo.
Oh, and Stormzy.
Stormzy
on Friday
and The
night.
Cure.
And The Cure. I mean,
who I've never
grew
seen
up to The Cure. You know, so I'm quite tempted, but I'm not sure if, quite apart from that, I'm not sure I can get tickets. I'm not sure if I have the energy. Because when I went, it was before I was ill last time. And you do need a lot of stamina, don't you? Especially if it's wet, because you can't sit down.
Oh, no. You totally underestimate the size of the site, how frustrating it is just getting anywhere, because the sheer amount of people and everything. But I saw a quote from Matt Hancock in the Evening Standard after last year's, or the year before's Glastonbury. He said, Glastonbury is a walking holiday with a bit of music thrown in. That's exactly it. And you totally forget how stressful it is.
Yeah.
And then you get there and you're in a foul mood for a lot of it.
Yeah.
But thank God you got your keys.
But I'm not a raver.
Not a raver,
particularly, though. But I have my favourite clubs. So my favourite clubs are Pasha in Ibiza.
Of course.
You know, just Naples Ultra. That is the best place. I think it's the best designed club interior space in the way, in sort of the vantage points and it's got atmosphere. I don't know what it is. I guess it's just decades of, you know, what's gone on there. That is my absolute favourite. There was an amazing night, which is where Brian and I used to go, called Fiction. That was in that whole part of King's Cross has now been developed, Bagley's Warehouse. And
oh, yes.
And opposite, there was a venue called The Cross. And it had this wonderful night called Fiction. It's, you know, classic sort of in a few railway arches, but it was just a really nice venue with great music. Those were my sort of two top favourites. And then someplace in New York that I went, I can't remember what it's called, for quite a few times. But no, those days are over.
Well, maybe. So if you are, dear listener, ever at Pasha in the future and think you see...
A tall, balding, ex-Tory MP. We did.
It's Nick Bowles.
We did last. So I basically, you know, I was ill for a year, and then I had a year of sort of vaguely recovering. And we agreed. I go to Ibiza pretty much every year with the same friend. And we've been going for 20, 30 years together. And she asked me out. At the end of my year of illness, and I'd had this blood stem cell transplant, you know, bone marrow transplant, which is meant to reboot your system of producing blood, and it wasn't working, and you know it's meant to your new stem cells are meant to sort of get kick into gear within a few weeks, and it had been months, and I was needing to have blood transfusions every week, a couple of times a week, and things were just stubbornly not improving. And it was a bit worrying because it might have then meant that I needed another one, and that would have to be somebody else's blood and stem cells, and that's much, much harder. So it was a little troubling. But I just said to my fantastic doctors at King's College Hospital that, you know, I really needed to go to Ibiza. I hadn't had a holiday for a year. Yeah. So we concocted this incredibly elaborate plan. And I had, you know, blood. I took blood out on the plane and all my various injections and had to get all these certificates. And they sort of double dosed me at the start of the week so that I'd be able to get through the whole
week. A lot of people double drop when they go to holiday.
Anyway, I got there. And then the curious thing is my friend booked this sort of classic Ibiza hippie shit, you know, sort of massage,
come,
you know, meditation, kundalini energy work.
Oh, wow.
Is what it's called.
Yes, yes, you chakras and all that.
One couldn't say that inappropriately, but kundalini. Anyway, so I had this from the when I was there, and I of course didn't go clubbing that week because I could barely move, but I did swim in the sea pretty much every day, and I came back. Went into the hospital, and my bone marrow was working.
Wow.
And so, of course, immediately we all declared it was Ibiza that
Ibiza
did it.
Heals.
You know, the ley lines, the, you know, all of this sort of stuff, all that hippie shit had worked. You know, it was the kundalini energy work after 9 months. Anyway, so then last year, which was a year after that, we agreed at that time that we were going to come back together and we were going to have a not dead yet night out. Yeah. And we were all so chuffed because we're all in our 50s. And we managed to stay out until 7 in the morning. And we danced the night away. They all then have concluded that Not Dead Yet is slightly macabre. next year, this year, August, it's going to be still going strong.
Oh, that's good. I can't think of a better note to end on. Nick, it's been an absolute pleasure having you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, there you go, Nick Bowles. Just what a guy. I'm just very grateful that he came in this week to speak to me, because I just think, you know, when someone's been at the centre of the news like that, it's great to talk to them right in the middle of it all. So who knows what happens next? But I mean, he's early 50s. He's, you know, obviously been through it with cancer, but he's fit and healthy. He's still got tons of ideas. What a shame it'd be, whether you're left, right, leave, remain, or none of the above. I think we can all agree it would be a shame if Nick Bowles wasn't involved in politics beyond the next few years. So hopefully he finds a way to stick around. You can email the show, of course, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for all your wonderful emails. Matthew Bennett got in touch from Sydney, Australia. He said, Matt, I'm a listener from Australia. I don't know why I said it like that. He said, I love the show. I'm super keen on the upcoming Ken Clark show. I'm very excited. He said, the above link is to a Harold Wilson conference speech. I thought you'd like it. It shows him at the peak of his political power and skill. I've never seen him so animated before watching this video. Matthew, Thank you so. It was a brilliant video. I loved watching it. If there are any political videos from yesteryear you would like to send in, please do send them in to politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. Let me know where you listen. And yes, just to remind you, the tour has been extended. The 25th of May, the Bloomsbury Theatre in London. You can get tickets for that show and all my other tour shows through the website mattford.com/live. I'll see you again next week. And this episode of The Political Party was produced by Daisy Knight.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code Program.